Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by your co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Politician Podcast. And today, we have a very special guest on our podcast, a current state representative for House District 50 in Georgia, the Georgia State Legislature, running for re-election this year to represent you for one more term in office. She is an immigrant from Germany and our third speaker who's an immigrant as part of the legislature, Damian, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
We had Sam Park and Representative Lopez Romero. So a very, very exciting interview coming up to you guys to go ahead. And to begin, I want to let Representative Couch kind of introduce herself to any of our viewers.
Yes, so thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Damian, Varun. So I'm very excited to be here on this Friday evening. Well, so you basically said it. I am the state representative for Georgia's House District 50, which covers most of Johns Creek. I'm an immigrant from Germany, came to the U.S. in 1997. And when we came to the U.S., if someone would have told me at that time that at one point would be a state legislator in any state, I would have told them, what are you talking about? But life moves forward and things happen and you find a new calling. And this is how I ended up here. It's quite an experience. I've been through my first session running for re-election, and I truly enjoy serving the people of Johns Creek. And it's a very, very fascinating learning experience because I get to work and be with so many people of different backgrounds. So that's what I enjoy most about it.
Yeah, and I think that you're doing a great job with campaigning. As I drive through Johns Creek with my dad, I'll see signs for your reelection, and I'll tell him that we're going to have you on the show this Friday. I was telling him just 2 days ago. I was like, we're going to have her on the show, and we're going to have a great conversation. But I guess my first question for you would be, what really got you into politics? You know, as being an immigrant, we've heard the stories of Sam Park, who's the first Asian representative here elected in Georgia's legislature, and obviously Brenda Lopez Romero, who's an immigrant from Mexico. What really, I guess, pushed you to go down this path? What made this your calling?
Well, let me circle back a little bit. We came to the U.S. In 1997, and I became an adjunct professor, and we kind of like thought about, initially we didn't think we would stay. Initially we thought we would only stay for 2 years, but you know, life happens, and then we got our green card, and we decided that we wanted to make the United States our permanent home. And when we did this, we said, okay, if we do this, then we only want to do this when we also have the opportunity to really participate. And for that, it is very important that you have the right to vote. So the only way you get the right to vote is if you become a U.S. citizen. So once we made this decision, we moved forward and said, okay, we want to live here, we want to have a voice, we want to truly participate. And we naturalized and became U.S. citizens in 2011. I'm originally from Germany, and Germans love to talk politics. So I grew up in a family where we talked about politics all the time, at the dinner table, at the lunch table. It was always a topic. Not that you're super politically active, but you're very, very politically aware. And so coming here initially, that changed a little bit because people tell you, the first thing they do is tell you there are two things you don't talk about, politics and religion. And I was like, oh. So So, but that changed. So to make a long story short, when we came to Georgia in 2015, we moved to Georgia from North Carolina. I got politically involved at the local level because they were just planning to build a park right next door where we live. And we had the neighbors had something to say about it. And that kind of like got me into it, how I learned how local politics works. And I got a feel for it. We went to some city council meetings. And then, of course, 2016 happened, and that changed a lot for many people. I was among the many women who went out and participated in the Women's March in January early, because I could not believe what had happened. You know, we became US citizens under the Obama administration, and there was this notion of hope and inclusiveness, and that we're moving to be a truly inclusive, diverse country, and where everybody really can pursue their American dream, whatever that dream is. It could be become an educator, researcher, or just finding a safe home for one's family. And we kind of like saw that idea deteriorate. All of a sudden, there was this hate speech, discrimination against minorities, the vitriol against religious groups or any minority group. And I said, I told to myself, this is actually not what I signed up for. It doesn't look like the vision of America I thought we were going to. And I really felt compelled to say, you know what, I can no longer sit idly by. I have to do something. I have to get up and be the change I can be. So I started the process and got active here in Johns Creek with the Johns Creek Progressive Campaign for John Ossoff a lot. I knocked at a lot of doors for John. And then when the time came that we were looking for someone to run for the House District 50, it was very interesting because this is a traditionally, it was seen as a traditionally Republican district, but we knew that the numbers told us that this is actually a purple district, that it was turning blue and nobody wanted to run. And then one day I told my friend Pallavi, who then became my campaign manager, I said, you know what, if nobody runs, I do it. And she just had a broad smile on her face and said, well, how about you talk to Bob Tremel, the minority leader, and we go from there. And this is basically how it started. I talked to Bob Tremel in November of 2017 and had my kickoff for the campaign in 2018. So I kind of like floated into that without a clear plan to do it. It just happened.
Right. And your story reminds me, representative of Ted Terry. He was our first ever guest on Politicine, and he told us about Damien. He told me and Damien about how he got into politics because of his girlfriend's family. He said, I wanted to impress their family, and that's why I'm in politics today. So you having these conversations at the dinner table and having to speak with your family on these issues, that's really, I think, important to people of any stage. And I think that when you talk about Obama and that kind of deterioration of the figurehead, Obama to me was a symbol of hope. He was a symbol of what people of color could do in America. And as you said, in 2016, we saw that deteriorate and really befall us. And I want to talk about that later, Representative. But before we go into the cold stuff, the deep stuff, and how America is really changing and has changed for the worst, I want to bring up one question for you. What do you think you like most about America? You know, being an immigrant, coming to America in, I guess, the middle of your life, what do you like most about America? And it, just before we go into the hard stuff.
So a very fascinating question. And I think in one word, I would summarize it as the American spirit. It is unique in a way that it truly gives us the feeling that you can come here and do or accomplish whatever you want if you put your mindset to it. And that is just overall, in especially in immigrants, instilled in their belief. And I think that is very, very, very unique to America, especially when I compare it to Germany. So I see my own example. When we moved here, I became an adjunct professor at colleges. I probably would never have done that in Germany. I worked in banking in Germany before. And then I had the opportunity to go into politics here. And that probably would not have happened in Germany either. So it really is the spirit of America that, you know what, here's a country that gives you the opportunity. If you grab your opportunity and you have the resources, then just go with it. And this is very inspiring and very entrepreneurish. So it's entrepreneurial spirit. And I think that is what makes America very unique compared to other countries.
And I'm looking here, and I remember looking in the research, and I can't remember necessarily the name of the university, but I think it was something along of Trier or Trier in Germany.
Yeah,
you have a master in business administration. So obviously, you know, what role would you say that plays kind of in your policies or the way that you perceive American politics or local politics here in Johns Creek?
Well, that's so long ago. Oh, my Lord. I have a master's in business administration, but I also have a master's in organizational communication from Western Michigan University. And the second master's actually influenced me more than the first one. The first one gives me a good understanding about economics. When people talk about business and economics, I can definitely join the conversation. However, the second one gave me the opportunity really to understand how the key to whatever you do is communication. I mean, some people with business, people like to be tied up in the numbers, but what we really are about is communication and knowing how we communicate, how we utilize communication, how it affects us and others. And right now we are in a time where we really change our way of communication because we go from a lot of interpersonal to social media and non-personal communication. So that influenced me and it gave me the opportunity to become an adjunct professor, which was a fascinating experience, and I found my love for teaching there.
That's truly inspirational, Representative. I don't know if you know this, but 1% of our viewers, our second most, I guess, populated field of viewers is from Germany. So we have, I think, 1% of our viewers. So I think one viewer per episode or something is from Germany. So that's pretty good to know going forward. I looked at that yesterday, and I was like, that's perfect. We have Representative Couch on the podcast. But besides the point. On the topic of education and how I think that education in your past and also in terms of creating a more, as you said, creating Americans that can achieve their dreams, no matter their socioeconomic status, education is the stepping stone for that is what I've always believed. And the interesting thing is that you and your opponent, Jay Lynn, the one policy I saw that you both have on your campaign platform is education, more funding for education. Now, I think that I want to go back here and talk about education as it relates to the coronavirus pandemic and how I think that as a student, I've seen many things that we have to do in order to, I think, increase the amount of support we have for students. For example, I saw in my district for Scythe County Schools, teachers are getting bombarded with work. You know, every teacher has online classes, in-person classes, and they're not hiring more teachers to take this load. And it's really, really a hard thing. To sell to teachers because they don't have any breaks. Like I've seen teachers like in class, like really depressed because they have no breaks for their time. And more importantly, classes that are full to the brink because you won't have enough teachers that are hired. So Do you have plans in order to hire more teachers to accommodate this kind of virtual learning? Because I think beyond investing in tech and online learning, we have to invest, in my opinion, in more teachers to facilitate safe in-person learning. What is your viewpoint on this? Is my first question on education.
Yeah, you touch a very, very critical issue. We actually talked about during the last session before the pandemic hit. One of the issues Georgia had before the pandemic hit, and we were still able to fully fund public education, was teacher retention and having enough teachers. So I think we had a shortage of roughly over, at ballpark number, 3,000 teachers, and half of them in Fulton County. So before we even talk pandemic scenarios, so now we have an additional scenario on that, because due to the pandemic, we had to cut the budget significantly. We all had to take out almost $1 billion out of public education. So public education, so that's K through 12 and higher education, makes about like 56% of the Georgia budget. So it's the biggest budget item in Georgia. Right. And so we talk a lot about education in the State House. And taking out $1 billion out of this budget hurts all schools, hurts all school districts. They're struggling with it. In addition to that, we have a scenario where teachers are put into into a high pressure environment. Either the discussion about whether they are in class or online teaching, and there's really no good answer, no solution to it. But what happened too is that some teachers decided to retire early, some teachers decided to not come back, and here's the thing: as an educator myself, you go into education or teaching because you love it. It's not necessarily where you go in and said, well, I'm going to do this because I'm going to make a lot of money. You right. You want it because you believe that you can make a difference in your students' lives, in whatever it is. And you get the reward out of making this difference. Now, in this situation we're having right now, it's get way more difficult. And we have four parties that are involved: teachers, parents, students, and administrators. And the current situation is really, really, it cannot sustain. My fear is out of this that we are actually going to widen the gap between those who can still afford to support the education and well-being of their children and those who can't. And that is the Georgia-wide issue we need to address. So my biggest concern is for the upcoming legislative session is like, how can we get Georgia back on track that we can go back to fully funding public schools? And those will be very tough discussions, because in order to do that, we have to find revenue in the state and make sure that we have the revenue to sustain the public education, which, as some of you may know, overall in Georgia is actually not as stellar. I mean, here in North Fulton and Forsyth, we are very blessed with very good schools, but some of the other areas in Georgia are school districts that are not doing as great. And we have to think of all school districts at the state legislature, not just of a few.
Yeah, I think that it's extremely important to focus on all school districts, and even on a personal level, the people that make up those school districts. Something that I've seen within Forsyth County, and I don't necessarily know if it's the same in Johns Creek, is the disparity or the difference between dropout rates when you're talking about different groups of people. Here in Forsyth County, the Hispanic population dropout rate is 25%, which is extremely high when you compare it to both African American students and white students, which are both 95%. Which are both 5%, 95% graduation rate, and 70% graduation rate for Hispanics. So what can we do to keep students in school? Because I think all of us agree, a big reason that schools opened in different parts of the state and different parts of the country is because of this idea that that in-person interaction and that in-person education is so crucial, but yet we see such a high dropout rate amongst minorities typically. So what can we do to either incentivize or push or kind of propel the idea that education, especially in high school, and obviously we want further education, but at least in high school, is the career or the idea that needs to be pursued?
Well, I would say that one, and this differs again, school district to school districts. And I'm just thinking about from a legislative standpoint how we could support this. I mean, first of all, I think as a parent, when my kids went to school, one of the things that is crucial we really need to foster in school, in every education, is how school districts, administrators, and individual schools can work together with parents, and that becomes more critical when we have a higher rate of immigrant population. population, especially like when there comes language barrier for example, for the Latino population, where there may be other issues involved, like work-related issues. They may be more migrating to where they find the next work. So it depends really on the life status of the families, and we have to make sure that the families, we can offer the families the support they need. From the state, I would say I would like to see, and we talked about this. I would like to see that DACA recipients are more integrated and really get a path to institution. So that's incentivized, and we had it's actually getting more and more bipartisan support in Georgia. And but the crucial point will be and for the future is how can we make sure that school districts that have a struggling percentage of their student population, as you said, like 25% of Latinos are dropping out, that's very high. How can we get the school districts the resources that they can actually address the issues? And I strongly believe that individual school districts are best suited to address it. So that will be the key to everything that's coming, is how can we ensure that we get the funding into the school systems?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to talk to you about, on that point, kind of going around that point about how education is segmented between races. I think that, first of all, you understand the struggles. As an immigrant, I think that you have more of a understanding of what they're facing in terms of language barriers, things like that. I think as immigrants, both yourself and your opponent have kind of some knowledge on that, but I want to ask you, because I'm looking at Jalen's campaign, right? And yeah. The majority of his campaign is around not defunding the police and keeping public safety intact and making sure we don't let go of that. And that's really what the Republican stance has been, and that's a very central part of his campaign. So I want to ask you what your response is to what's going on in today's nation: racial riots, racial tensions, and the recent instances of police brutality. And how you think we can find a solution to that? Because Jalen has been constantly saying that we can't defund the police. We have to protect our police. I don't know how you feel about that. I want to ask you what you think the path forward is, because I just want to make sure I hear from both sides here.
Well, the path forward is, and you know, we had some issues here with the former police chief in Johns Creek that really, really amplified the issue for a city like Johns Creek, who before had always thought that they did not have a lot of issues with their police. And for me, the question is, so what is really at stake here? When I talk to police officers and police chiefs, you know what the first thing they tell me is, when I ask them, so what can we as state legislators do to help you? And I get the response, and you can ask almost any police chief around the country, is, can you do something about mental health? And mental health is the number one issue police officers dealing with, because they get a lot of calls to, let's say, domestic violence situations. They get called, they say, 50 here in Johns Creek, former police chief, now city manager at Densmore, once told me that probably 50% of their calls are mental health calls. So my question is, that is big. And then you have police officers who go into the communities and they want to serve the communities, keep them safe. I mean, we need public safety, absolutely, but they may not be equipped to handle every situation in the way it should be addressed. So I would say that we need to work with local police and to ensure that they get the resources need to address this, maybe have more training, maybe talk about adding more social workers to the police departments to work on what needs to be done. More training on racial issues is definitely something I would love to see, and where I all have to see. I think we all could learn from that. I don't like to go into this divisionary language my opponent is using, because I don't know. I don't [S2] Right. [S1] Think it's helpful. Because as a state legislator, I think we need to come together where we find where we find a way that we address the things that are wrong. And we've seen horrible instances of police brutality, which have now been, I mean, the killing of George Floyd or the shooting in the back of Jacob Blake. Those are incidents that stick with the mind of the broader populace in the United States. For me, it is like, okay, this, if this is what, and one of the answers you hear from people is they say, well, yeah, the police officers were following procedure. And my question is then, okay, if they are covered because or protected because they say they were following procedures, then we really have to ask ourselves the questions, what is wrong with the procedures and how do we need to change the procedures in order that behavior like this in the end does not get sanctions because those police officers cannot get punished even if they did something wrong. But on the other hand, we got to be very careful because I'm very strongly against alienating the police because we need public safety. We need good police officers and we have a lot of good police officers. So I am all for community engagement, improving the relationship between police and community, bring them more together. And I know that out of the incidents we had here in Johns Creek, that we have a very engaged citizens group that is now trying to work on coming solutions and bringing proposals to, for example, the city of Johns Creek and how they want their police department to improve working together with them. And that citizen engagement is, I think, is very, very important to rebuild the trust that has been lost, because it is about trust. When I see a police officer, and I'm talking as an elected official now, I'm glad I'm seeing one because this person, I feel this person needs to protect me, but I have to trust this person that they're doing the job. But we have groups in the city that feel threatened when they see a police officer, and the question is, why is that? And how do we overcome this? And this has in part to do with systemic racism that US just has evolved over hundreds of years. I mean, it's embedded in the founding of this nation. And it still needs to be addressed. But we only can address it when we continue the discourse and come together and really find solutions out of this. But that requires that everybody at the table is really committed to work towards change, and I think that is what's going to be very, very challenging, because the national discourse is very divisionary, and I don't even want to go there because I don't think it's helpful. It's hurtful.
Right, and our last candidate on the podcast, William Hughes, said, we're just talking about solutions and not just disputing the fact. We know what the facts are. We know that when a black man sees a police officer, he doesn't think of law enforcement. He thinks of his rights being taken away, of George Floyd being held his knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. That's what a black man thinks of when he sees a police officer. We have to recognize those facts and create solutions. Now, I talked to Fani Willis before she became the DA. She currently recently got elected as a DA of Fulton County. I don't know if you heard about that. I interviewed her earlier this year, and she talked to me about her plans for Fulton County. And her plans were centered around diversion programs, and having these programs to not just convict people and put them in jail for crimes, but to really focus upon mending them and reentering them back into society without really hurting them and creating that kind of trauma. But more importantly, Fani did something that I've never seen anybody do in my studies on criminal justice and policing. She focused upon the communities. Right. And she said, I want to have these programs for young kids to come out and to teach them what it means to be a good citizen. So we don't have these kids without fathers coming out and committing crimes. We don't have these kids without mm-hmm. the proper education, literacy training to come out and commit these crimes. She wanted to create the kind of good relationship between these kids and the law so they don't go along the wrong path. And she wanted to create a better future for all. So I think that it's important for us to look forward 10, 15, 20 years in the future. Yep. When we talk about these justice issues.
Yeah, and it's funny that you remember, I've mentioned Fani Willis. She is actually a friend of mine, and I endorsed her campaign, and I'm absolutely super thrilled that she is our new DA-elect, because I think she's going to do a fantastic job, because she really she really knows the fact that we need to break the school to prison pipeline, as we call it. Mm-hmm. And we really need to start thinking about what things can we do to really keep people out of jail that shouldn't be there. For example, in January, I had the opportunity to visit the Fulton County Jail. And again, when we talked to Sheriff Ted Jackson and the officers there, what they presented was like, we have a lot of people in jail that shouldn't be here. We have drug addicts, yeah. they should be in treatment. We have mental health, people with severe mental health disorders, bipolar disorder, they should be in treatment centers that can help them. They should not be in jail. And for me, it's like, it's also, when you think about it, like when we talk about the budget, it's not good allocation of our resources. If we spend money on having people in jail that shouldn't be there, the moment they get out there, I mean, if they are in jail, whatever happens in their court case, they either come be transferred to prison where they really shouldn't belong, and whatever happens if they come back and are being released into society, they still have the same problems. So and this is why investing in mental health, investing in drug and rehabilitation treatments is so crucial to really break that, what Fanny talked about, which is really in some population groups stronger, is really breaking the school to prison pipeline. And I'm a very, very hopeful that we can work together to find better solutions to do that. We have some legislative proposals with the Democratic Caucus that we are working on, but we will see. We have to first go through the election in November to see how we can implement them.
Yeah, and I absolutely love all of the ideas that I'm hearing here. I think that something very strong that you bring up is this idea that we don't need to alienate police. I 1000% agree with that. If anything, I think that we need to unify the police more with the community. And I'd say the only unfortunate thing about that is that the community has to take the lead there, where I believe that the police department should be taking the leads to try to make everyone feel unified. Because when you alienate, it goes towards this idea of us against them.
Yeah, so, I absolutely agree. As I said, all parties at the table have to be committed to that joint goal.
1000%. And, you know, speaking of unification, I want to bring this up a little bit later, but we're going to cut to a quick message from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with the podcast. One, and we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politeen. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Politeen podcast, which myself and one of my best friends, Damian Galvin, created in our junior years of high school to deconstruct issues of the past and present to create a more equitable future for all. Now, today we have a very, very broad-reaching discussion on the future of our nation and the election coming up this November. And it's a kind of a solo episode with me and Damian just talking about issues that we think are most important for our viewers to hear, and things that we're very passionate about. So without further ado, I guess we can begin today, Damian.
Yeah, for sure. So I think a little bit of housekeeping, you know, we're human here on the podcast. So we got to give you guys a little bit of a peek behind the curtain. We're going to change our schedule to Mondays and Fridays at 7 p.m. It's just going to work easier with school, as you guys know. And as Varun mentioned, we're juniors. So, you know, this is the year where a lot of you can relate to just being loaded on homework and after school activities and joining different clubs. And we have the podcast, but the podcast, I think, has slipped to the back of our minds. And now if we have them on Monday and Wednesday, I think it's going to be a lot easier for us to keep you guys in the loop about what we're thinking. I'm excited, honestly, to do a little bit of the solo episodes. I don't know if you are. Like, I enjoy kind of that aspect, too, of just being able to talk to you. It's great learning, but sometimes there's so much that happens during the week that you just feel like you have to get off your chest. And that's really what I love about the podcast.
Absolutely. It gives us both an opportunity to speak to just America and speak to people who want to listen to us. I think solo episodes are good, Damien. I like speaking to you, to our viewers, about things that I'm passionate about, because I think that this week has been very, very, very unnerving. I'm sure you can relate. It's been very, very, I guess, a point of passion. I've been in North Carolina this entire, I guess, the past couple of days, Saturday to today. And What I've seen, what I've experienced for the first time in my life is I've seen people's political beliefs on their face. And I'm saying that because a person without a mask on shows me that they're ignorant and that they're following in Trump's propaganda, the conservative propaganda. And for the first time in my life, I have seen that without having to dig deeper. It's so apparent in today's world. And it's just, I just realized that today and I was like, I got to bring this in. I got to talk about it today. And it's unnerving. And it's weird because, I mean, when you're going around looking at people without a mask on, it's almost like I'm scared because it creates a sense of fear within me. And it's just, I don't think in today's scope, it is okay. It was the first time I've really been out of the state since the pandemic, barring this summer where I was in Chicago. But it really did open me up to the true nature of our country as being so divided upon partisan lines to where we can't even decide upon the most simple of safety precautions in our nation. And it brings me back to the point that we can see your political party, your political standpoint, but more importantly, your sense of empathy on your face.
Yeah, I think that it's beyond I think face masks are beyond politics, to be honest. Like, even though they have a political alignment, right? Like, the idea that Republicans don't wear masks and, like, Democrats do, I think that it goes beyond that. I think it transcends it a little bit. I think most good Republicans will still wear masks. I think that really it is a point of ignorance. And this week has been so frustrating on so many different fronts. But we are a podcast that talks about socio-political issues. So I think I want to focus a little bit on some socio before we hop in into the heavy hitting stuff. I mean, how have you been, Varun? I actually just wanted to bring this up because I thought that this was pretty cool. I don't know if you know who David Blaine is.
Let me know who he is.
Well, David Blaine, he's kind of like Houdini. Like a street performer and stuff. He like was buried alive for a week. And he stood in ice for 70 hours, something like that. He stayed awake for like extremely long amounts of times, held his breath for like 20 minutes. He's done some pretty crazy stuff. But this past week, I think it was September 2nd, this has absolutely nothing to do with politics for all our listeners, by the way. It's just something that I thought was cool and something that, you know, I wanted to bring on before we dive into some of the heavy stuff. But he got lifted up into 24,900 feet in the air by a couple of balloons. And I thought that was just crazy. That was cool. I heard of it on the Joe Rogan podcast. Obviously, you know, we're podcasters. We listen to different podcasts and we kind of shape even our podcast off of that podcast. But it was really cool to actually see it happen. He went up to 24,000 feet and put his parachute on in midair. It was really cool. It was really cool to watch. And it's something that kind of distracted us from what would occur later in the week with, you know, the piece that came out about the president's rhetoric towards veterans and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, this weekend's been pretty revealing to me too.
Happy Labor Day, by the way.
Oh yeah. Happy Labor Day. All of our viewers, to you, Damien, all of our working class Americans, happy Labor Day. That's very important, for Politi and for us. But in terms of my weekend, I think I've watched a lot of podcasts being on the road. I was driving, for the most part, over to the mountains this weekend. Mm-hmm. So a good getaway, but a lot of podcasting. I've been listening to podcasts around psychology. Obviously, one of my favorites, Pod Saves America. I've been listening to that one, Washington Week, Pod Saves the People. A lot of good podcasts to bring you guys more content, more perspectives, and more opinions. So that's, I guess, where I gain the most information for the podcast. It's off of people's perspectives, and that's where I learn the most. It's it's about really listening to those perspectives and bring them to you guys as viewers. But without further ado, I think we should... First of all, I think we should begin on a point that you mentioned earlier, Damien. It's the point that the president has used very, very derogatory rhetoric towards veterans, and that's been revealed, I think, strategically by the Biden campaign, not by the Biden campaign, but by people, his past generals. But go ahead if you want to explain that more in detail, Damien.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, I'm drinking a protein shake while recording this. Getting back into better habits as we're kind of here fixing our podcast schedule. I got to fix my sleep schedule and stuff. But to stay on topic... I mean, to be fair, he's denied it. I mean, who wouldn't deny it? I think that it's, you know, at this point, just it's odd because, you know, you're always supposed to give people the benefit of the doubt. And I do so over and over again with the president. But this is what I think, right? And hear me out. If a story like this would have come out with Obama, people would have just been like, it's not true. Right? If a story like this would have come out with Joe Biden, people would have just been like, it's not true. It wouldn't have gained any traction. But the fact that this story can even have some sort of validity shows us like the climate that our country is in, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Now, I think that when you're talking about this instance, it's not unprecedented. Because if you think about what he said about John McCain, he has called John McCain not an American hero.
That's what I'm saying.
He has been caught. So the fact that this is precedented, you can kind of build the backbone for these statements early on in his career, talking about things he said about the military, talking about John McCain, talking about, I guess, a loser's funeral, as he mentioned it. Really, you can find where he led
loser.
Up to it. An effing loser. That we don't know completely, but we know Trump called him
he called him a loser.
Because he was caught. Now, the worst thing is that Trump wouldn't even put his name into the draft. He basically got out of the American draft for war because of his family status. Himself and his family were out of the draft. So what does that say about being patriotic? The fact that you call American war hero, a POW who suffered torture at the hands of our enemies for this nation, for freedom, and for peace, a loser. It says a lot because you never put your name into the draft. It says a lot to fight for your nation. I don't think Trump's ever fought for his nation. As president, you can say what you want. But I, in my personal being, do not believe that Trump has ever fought for our nation in any capacity.
Yeah, he's fought for himself. I think something that was funny, obviously I'm happy to see that everyone's okay. And a lot of people thought that I'd be pissed. Here locally, there was a couple of like boat rallies. I think it's called Boaters for Trump or something. There was a couple in Dallas.
The great American boat rally.
That's what it was called. And there was, I think there was one in Dallas where 5 boats sank. And I was reading a news story on it, and one of the comments on the article said, "I like boats that don't sink. These are some suckers and losers." And obviously, it's funny because everyone's okay. And I'm glad that everyone's okay. But it was just such a twist on the rhetoric that Trump's been spreading. And then it's funny to see people get mad at that person, and then be like, if you understand the context of the joke where he says, the Bush was a loser because he got caught, right? His soldiers died. He was one of the only soldiers. I think 8-9 planes went down with him, and he was one of the, I think he was the only soldier that made it out, right? Here you're making a joke about, a couple boats sinking and some idiots, frankly, that didn't have life jackets on that are lucky to have made it out. But beyond the point, something that really pissed me off, and we're talking a little bit about social media here, because I said that I saw that article, but it was an article posted on an Instagram page. And something that I posted, kind of just trying to transition here, onto my Snapchat was, the president and his staff are inhumane. The president and his staff are inhumane. And this post came after I saw a tweet from one of his highest staffers making fun of Joe Biden for visiting his son's grave. And I just can't comprehend that, right? Like, okay, attack the man on his mental capacity, still not about politics. Attack the man on this or that. Keep it political. But when you're saying that he's, I don't remember the word. He was like maundering around the grave, saying that he was basically
meandering.
That's what it was. Meandering along the grave. It's just like, it's such a point of disrespect, right? No one said anything about the president's brother. No one said anything, why bring it to that point? Why bring it? And why not take down the tweet if you realize that it was insensitive? What pisses me off the most is that they try to explain the tweet afterwards. They know what they did. Just take it down, right? Be a real person. Have empathy. At the end of the day, sure, we can be going through some political turmoil, but I think the state of the union is broken. And it's broken in the sense that we've lost so much respect for each other that we can't even have a father mourn at his son's gravesite without the president's staff, the president of the United States, the president of the free world, his staff, the people he hires, making fun of him. And that hit the wrong spot with me. First of all, it's not just his son, right? It's not just his son. He's a hero to all of us because he fought in Afghanistan, he could be visiting some random person's gravesite. It's disrespectful, period, to make comments like that. It's disrespectful, period, to make comments about a father visiting, you know, a veteran, a deceased veteran's gravesite, and it's most disrespectful to just be, it's just the rhetoric. Like, I can't understand. You know how fast that person would have been fired in any other administration, whether it's Bush, Reagan, Obama, no matter the administration, that person would have been relieved of their duties immediately. That's not political. That's un-American. That's unpatriotic. And frankly, I'd call it, I don't want to get upset about it, but it's not because it's Joe Biden. If someone would have done that to Donald Trump, it would have upset me. We don't need to, that's such a low blow, and it just, low blows piss me off.
Yeah, and I think that you have to mention Bo, as Bo the soldier, Bo the Biden, and more importantly, Bo the American hero. And you have to consider that whenever you say something. Now, the context behind this story was that the reporter in the video was saying, Mr. Vice President, come talk to him. And Joe Biden, he waved his hand and walked away. And the issue with this whole situation is the fact that Joe Biden's at a cemetery, clearly visiting his son's grave, his dead son's grave. Bo Biden, again, the American hero. And this is not unprecedented, Damien. Once again, going back to the idea that things like these are not unprecedented. Back in July, an RNC spokesman posted a picture of Joe Biden and his son, Bo Biden, once again, as he was a kid, in a Redskins hat, saying, "Hey, Joe Biden, are you still a Redskins fan?" Because of the whole controversy around the name. Now, again,
but there was an implement. There was just such. There was an implication under that. If you felt it, did you feel the undertone under that? Absolutely. Because it was like, "Are you still a Redskins fan, knowing your son's dead in that hat?"
I saw the more of an undertone in that one. I did, and this one. Both of them are just terrible instances. I think you have to mention the fact that campaigns in the past, like you said, have been run on empathy. That's why John McCain, when he selected Sarah Palin as vice president, he didn't feel that it was right in the Republican Party, because he was seeing so much hatred towards Obama as an Arab, as a terrorist. Things like these were being said in the Republican Party, and he felt bad about it. He wanted to run a good campaign. Steve Schmidt, John McCain, these were good people wanting to run a good campaign. And that's why, if you think about it, John McCain, the woman who said, I'm scared of Obama. Obama's an Arab. He's like, no, Obama's a good family man. Obama's a good American citizen. He wanted to run a campaign that prided the American values, prided American empathy, and just only emphasized a small difference in their policies. He didn't want to shoot low blows like that. That was the real issue. I think right now we're shooting low blows every single day. And when you're shooting a blow as low as to disrespect an American hero, disrespect the vice president's son, and disrespect everything about that is just messed up. I can't comprehend just why he said it and why the person isn't fired, because the firing privilege is in one person's hand, and that's Donald Trump. If Donald Trump, as Mike Cohen said in his book, and he has pictures to prove this, hired an Obama impersonator to yell at and to fire and to constantly throw jabs at, he can fire a guy who disrespected the vice president, an American hero. He can't. It's in his hands. So I don't know if you read Mike Cohen's book, but that was disturbing by any measure. I want to pivot back to that. The fact that he hired, there's pictures of this actually, of him and the Obama impersonator in the White House. And he hired him to yell at him and to fire him because of how much hatred he had towards the president. But more than that, I think it is a deep-rooted sense of that he couldn't stand up to the privilege, to the standard that Obama put forth as a standard bearer. I think he was just upset by that and wanted to lash out at somebody. And that's just a sign of a narcissist, a sign of a person who's mentally unstable. It's something that I think we should talk about, consider. But before we do it, I want to also go back to your point on the boats. And I think it's funny, Damien. I think it's funny because I saw the same tweet on my Twitter page, and I retweeted it on PolitiTeam. It said, "I prefer boats that don't sink. USS John S. McCain." Take that as you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that the reason that he'll never be able to live up to the Obama administration, and the reason that he'll never be able to live up to the Reagan administration, say what you will about Reagan, right? People still love him. The reason he'll never live up to the Bush, and the reason that he's never going to live up to the administration that precedes him, which hopefully, you know, if you go out this November and vote, it's going to be the Biden administration, right? A new poll came out. Biden's leading by 10%. And you want to know why? It's because right now America needs a man, not a boy. Right? They don't need a little boy in the Oval Office. And I keep saying it over and over again, because a little boy only does the things that the so-called president of the United States is doing right now. Right? You know, I never agreed with the thing, not my president. I never agreed with it because, frankly, he is my president, right? He's the president of the United States. And for that, I can hold a certain level of respect towards him, right? There's things that I want to say about Donald Trump, right? But I even have to hold myself back, because at the end of the day, he is a father, right? He's a father. He's a son. I can hold some sort of empathy, some sort of compassion towards him, right? But it becomes so difficult when you see that person can't do the same. And I'm not a very religious person, but it only leaves one option, and that's to pray for them, right? I mean, you talk about getting the Anglo-Saxon vote or whatever, the religious, the Christian vote. I think that the Christian vote's kind of switching towards Biden's side. And I think that, frankly, this administration needs a lot of prayer. And it just hurts me to see that someone can be so small, right? Someone can be so small as to make remarks such as the ones that the president has made. And I'm not just talking about the ones that are alleged. I'm talking about the ones that are just on record, right? Sure, we can talk about the ones that are alleged remarks that he made behind closed doors. But what about we just talk about the ones that he says at his rallies? What about we just talk about the ones that he has on Twitter? Why don't we talk about the ones that he has recorded? What about, grab him by the pussy, right? That's what about making fun of an autistic reporter? What about making fun of John McCain? We don't need to focus on the ones that are behind closed doors. We don't need to defend them. Sure, he can deny them, but what's he going to do about those? Is it just locker room talk when you're disrespecting a dead soldier? Is it just locker room talk when you have kids in cages at the border wall? Is it just locker room talk when you can't say that what Kyle Rittenhouse did was wrong?
Yeah, there's no vindication for it, Damien. I think it is strategic, though, because these racial undertones have been in America for so long, in our nation for so long, and I think Trump is playing upon these undertones to power forth his campaign. I think it is very strategic because America, I don't believe in what Nikki Haley said. I don't believe in it. I think America has been racist systematically, and I think America is racist. I think it is, because the fact that a person is in our office who supports, who doesn't go against white supremacists, and by doing so is complicit in their actions, just disturbs me and shows me that America in its roots is still a racist nation. The fact that we have somebody, I keep mentioning it, silence is complicity. The fact that Trump is silent about these instances, and not even silent about Kyle Rittenhouse, he's advocating for Kyle Rittenhouse in his press conferences, means he is complicit by any measure.
I want to counter that. America is not inherently racist. America is inherently silent. America inherently does not show up to the voting booth, right? 52% of Americans are going to vote. What happens to the other 48%? Right? That's what America is. America does not voice our opinions. As Americans, it is our obligation. And we're going to see this November, as Americans show up to the polls, after the events took place with the I've had family members, as I'm sure most of listeners of the podcast, I've had family members, serve in the military. I've had family members that you don't know if they're going to come back home. I've had family members on both sides of it. I've had family members in Mexico deported, and I've also had them sent to Afghanistan. And to know that you can have such disrespect for people, and I'm not just talking about the ones that are behind closed doors. I'm talking about just up front. I think that when America's voice is heard, and when Americans really voice their opinions, we can see that America is not inherently racist. But the problem is when American voices are suppressed. And I think that this November, I'm seeing it every single day. Vote, 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 and vote. If Americans vote, we will prosper as a nation. If Americans vote, the ideology that we want to pursue as the best country, the greatest country in the world, will prosper. When Americans vote, the proper opinions get heard and the proper decisions get made. So if you choose not to vote, I do not want to hear you complaining about the state of the union. And if you can't vote and you chose to stay at home doing who knows what, spending time doing who knows what and not voicing your opinion in some way, helping in some way, bringing a discussion in some way, then you should not voice your opinion on the when the nation is down. You shouldn't. You need to go out and you need to voice and you need to be heard and you need to frankly encourage everyone who is above 18 to vote, because again, when that happens, that is when America is truly going to be the greatest country in the world.
It brings me back to the point that silence is complicity. Mm-hmm. Because in 2016, I didn't believe it so much. Because not voting meant you were, I guess, you thought Hillary was going to win either way. Or you thought that was a norm that was going to stay. And I don't respect that either way. But now, the risks of what can happen are so clear to where being silent is being complicit. And if America elects Trump to one more term, I will take anybody who was silent, who didn't vote, who didn't voice their opinions, as being complicit in the racism and the bigotry that is in the White House.
Even if they vote for Trump.
Even if you vote for Trump, that is a vote for racism and for bigotry.
Well, what I was saying is that you need to vote for whatever, man. As long as if you go out and vote and you voice your opinion, I don't have an issue with it.
At this point in the election, I have an issue if you vote for Trump. I do, and I'll say that with a strong vindication. I have a strong, because doing so, it means you're not supporting your peers. It means you're not placing your backing behind the rest of the United States of America, your POC peers, because Trump has most blatantly come out, and now more than ever blatantly come out and gone against the values of this country. A vote for Trump is an un-American thing, I believe, at this point, because we've seen enough. In 2016, it was one thing. In 2016, even I thought when Trump got elected, maybe he will change. Maybe he would learn more about politics. It's not going to happen. We've seen it. American lives are at stake. A vote for Trump is a vote against the prosper of our nation, because 188,000 American lives have died. One of my friends, he told me, I'm voting for Trump because I'm pro-life. And I said, you're so pro-life that you're voting for a guy who allowed 188,000 Americans to die. That's how pro-life you are. Mm-hmm. And it was shocking, because he had no response. He had no response. And that's the state of the union right now. He had no response. And so I think that if we pressure people and ask them, what is in it for you, they would understand what the implications are. Steve Schmidt, for example, a big campaign staffer on John McCain's campaign, is a big anti-Trumper. Kellyanne Conway's husband is a co-founder of the Lincoln Project. These people are coming out and understanding that going against Trump is pro-democracy, pro-union, pro-POCs. It is a vote for America going forward. And I think that when you're going back to the point of Trump in 2016, they say it now. They say Trump is a celebrity and Trump mm-hmm. isn't a politician. And that's why I love Trump, right? The issue with that is that people said the same thing about Obama. They were like, Obama's a celebrity. Obama knows how to speak to people. That's why I'm voting for him. The difference is that Obama was a constitutional law professor at U of Chicago. Obama had a background in the legal field, and Obama was a little bit more than a celebrity.
He was a man. That's the only difference.
He was a man. And I think that right now, more than ever, America needs not only a man, but we need a politician to get us past this dark, dark, dark period in our country's history.
Yeah, and to be frank, we don't need – I say he was a man. Because of the idea, you know, sure, you can be a woman. I think I'm trying to figure out how to word this. It's just the power, right? I think the better word is adult. He was an adult, to be frank, right? It's the kid in the Oval Office right now. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. You can still be a strong adult. What we need right now is a leader. And you can't have a leader when your catchphrase, right? The thing that you're known for is something that tears people apart. You're fired, right? That's what you're known for. You can't be a leader when the only thing that you want to lead is yourself, right? You can't be a leader when defacing and tearing down Americans and their lives is what your campaign runs on. And you can't be a leader when you're playing golf and 180,000 Americans are dead. I don't think that any president, I've never agreed with this. I've never agreed with the idea of a president of the United States playing golf. You know, sure, they can
Obama did do it.
Yeah, Obama did it. And what pisses me off about the right-wing media right now is that they criticize Obama so harshly for playing golf. And they're letting Trump do it every single day. They're letting him do it when 200,000 Americans are dead. And they're letting him do it when his campaign staffer, right, at the exact same time that his campaign staffer, or that, sorry, Biden was visiting his son's grave, Trump was playing a round of golf. But I say that to say this. I think right now we need someone that will never settle, right? And someone that beyond the obstacles put in front of them, they won't give up. Filing for bankruptcy doesn't show that beyond the obstacles put up in front of you, you won't give up. It shows that, hey, I have the money to do it, so I'm going to do it. Right, I'm just gonna do it because I want to. I can't understand right now. Right, playing a game when Americans are dying, and I can't understand it. Period, because there's always Americans suffering, and there's always some proposal, or some meeting, some idea that you can be coming up with as president of the United States. But even I think more so right now. Right? 200,000 in the midst of a pandemic, your priority is putting a ball in a hole with a stick.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think you're right. A couple of points I want to make. Trump plays golf at 2 times the rate of Obama. I read this stat on a news site. It was 2 times as much as Obama on CNN's own statistics. So beyond that, what really, really made me mad was that on Twitter, as I literally saw reports of Trump playing golf at, I think, one of his resorts in the U.S., he tweeted, "I can't go boating with you," talking about the Great American Boat Rally, "because I'm fully focused on November," right? And at the same instance, literally the same time frame, Trump is saying, he's saying that he's focused on November, he's playing golf. And I think that it really shows how dishonest he is to the American people, and more so, how little he cares about American lives. Again, yep. Beyond him playing golf as hundreds of thousands of Americans are dead, it is what it is. It is what it is. When a reporter asked him in an Axios interview, "What do you think about American lives being lost in the coronavirus pandemic?" He said, "It is what it is." It yep. shows an utter lack of respect. And more importantly than that, you mentioned the point that Trump loves saying you're fired. Well, it shows how much of a child he is, but he can't say "you're fired" to his own staffer who disrespected an American hero and threw cheap shots at his opponent. I think you have to consider a man who has lived his life saying "you're fired" cannot say "you're fired" to a staffer who has done such a thing. And it really shows the kind of person that Trump is. But not to say that I didn't know about it. Like we've known what kind of person Donald Trump is.
I don't know why we keep pretending. That irritates me. The fact that we keep pretending.
Well, pretending was seen at the RNC, more specifically. The entire conference, they were pretending Trump is some kind of god, some kind of hero. The last night of the RNC, Trump's speech was completely scripted. None of his usual blabber. He is not the kind of person that they depicted him as. And that's a simple fact of the matter. When you look at how he's speaking right now, it does not show the empathy, the compassion towards the middle class that they painted him as. I think that's not the way to go for the Republican Party, because as you keep painting him in that light, he'll keep disbanding your paintings. He's never going to live up to that, Damien. He's never going to. And I think that the more you paint him as that, the more you give the left-wing media, the media sources, things to pray apart at on, because he's not living up to your expectations, and he's never going to. I think if they want to win, they have to phrase Trump as a practical candidate, and they have to bash Biden. But they can't do it by phrasing him as compassionate, because simply put, he's not that. He has never been that, and he will never be that.
And we're back. So this idea that I was talking about, unification, it was actually something that popped up earlier on my Twitter feed. You know, obviously today is 9/11. We're recording this at least on 9/11. You guys will see this on 9/13, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 9/14 Monday. But earlier today, the Vice President, Joe Biden, and Mike Pence met at a remembrance for 9/11, and they actually talked. They had a little elbow bump, and me and Varun were actually talking on our previous episode about how I'm just dying to wait for the moment where either, you know, where Donald Trump and Joe Biden shake each other's hand. And just saying that, every time that I think about it, it just kind of it pushes this idea of unification, which I think is so important. And I think that we're becoming extremely polarized. And I'm starting to see this polarization. It's typically, polarization has always been prominent, I think, on the federal level in American history. Even with the founding fathers, you had, you know, Alexander Hamilton would have his scuffles with pretty much every founding father, but you would have all these differing ideas.
I challenge you for a little bit here.
Sorry.
Because you say the term, which a little pedal back when we became U.S. citizens in 2011, I also went to start my master's in U.S. history. I didn't finish it, but I took a lot of classes. And one thing I learned there is, why do we always say founding fathers? And what about the other people who helped found this nation? So I always like to say, what would Abigail Adams say about that? So there is this notion that we have about like these founding fathers who created this nation. But I did a lot of social history, and we always need to acknowledge that the building of this nation was done on the backs of a lot of people. A lot of people continue to that. So let's said it because it's something we always said.
Yeah.
Say and there's nothing wrong with this, because this is the terminology we all grew up with. But I said, think about it. It's there were more than the people who wrote the Constitution.
Yeah, I 1,000% agree with that. And I love our terminology being challenged. I think Dr. Roberts did that as well. I don't remember exactly what we said, but he challenges our terminology, and I absolutely love that, because it gives you a different idea and a different perspective onto what you're thinking. But you know, on that train of thought, where you have this kind of always polarization in the federal level, it's a lot more difficult, or I'd say it's difficult in times to see that on a local level. But I think that we're definitely feeling that on all levels of government now. So what can we do as a nation moving forward, as a community, whether it be locally or federally, to be less polarized and to come together? Obviously, we had the leaked tapes of you know, the president saying that he was trying to make the American people confident, and we discussed this on the last podcast as well, where that's not confidence, that's lying. Confidence is telling the American people, as you say, the spirit of the American people, telling them that we can get through this together, that we can do anything that we dream of, as long as we're working hard, and that we will get through it. So what do you think is that step forward to coming back together as the American people?
Oh, well, you're asking the million-dollar question, and because in this divisive nation that we are now, everybody talks about unification, but I think what we've come to, that we come a little bit at the last how to unify again, because we are living in different realities. So, and I'm seeing it when I talk to, for example, to Republicans, it's almost like we talk different languages. So we have to overcome one thing. First of all, I think we have to stop the lies. We need to come back to a language where we can believe, trust in science, and the facts, and really make sure that this is the basis of our communication. And for that, we need to find a way how we deal with social media and the misinformation campaigns that are out there, that are out there to misinform us on purpose. I believe that on the federal level, we probably need to find a way to somehow find a way to regulate it, or to get, let's say, institutions like Facebook and Twitter to really be do more self-censoring when they know there are really wrong information out there. But that's a very challenging cause to pursue. So I hope that my hope is that someone like Joe Biden, when he becomes president, because he is like the grandfather in the political landscape right now, with his experience of 50 years, that he has the ability to really reach across the aisles again and bring us more together. That's truly my hope. But it will be challenging. We have to find a way. And here's my challenge to the young people. I mean, you are politically engaged, but what kind of like active, active challenge do you put on yourself, or commitment, or a challenge, like are we going out and really having a talk with people who think differently than us? And we are in a society where we can kind of like hide in our echo chambers and our silos, and that is very dangerous, and we have to get out there. So we all should purposely have like community circles where we sit together, where we really engage in conversations with people who think differently than us, because that's the only way how we can bridge that divide. And it will be a long and slow, painful process.
Yeah, I agree with that 1,000%. I think that even goes on to racial issues, kind of having the uncomfortable conversations when your ideas are challenged. It's really with all issues in American politics and in American life. But, you know, you were mentioning Joe Biden and Joe Biden becoming president. You know, I think a lot of Americans want to see that. But I'd say that the biggest issue, or the biggest hurdle to Joe Biden becoming president, is Americans going out and voting. This isn't just a hurdle because some Americans are politically disengaged. This is also a hurdle because some Americans are disenfranchised. Yes. And you have gentrification, whether it be... gerrymandering, when it comes to, you know, different people being able to vote, whether it's because of public transportation or where the voting booths are placed, or when you're voting, or even it comes down to the job that you have, whether they allow you to get off of work that day. And now a pressing issue is the mail service, because a lot of, you know, American citizens and Georgians are going to request mail-in ballots. What is the Georgia legislation? What in particular are you trying to do to make sure that every American voice is heard?
Well, I can only speak. Let's start with the current election. So we just have to be very pragmatic. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not a lot I can do personally about the U.S. mail. We just would hope that U.S. mail gets enough funding that they can do their job. But we just need to do a lot of voter education. And for the people who request the mail-in ballot, and by the way, there are people request the mail-in ballot across both aisles, Democrats and Republicans, and both are at the same risk of their vote not being counted because it may not make it in the mail early enough. But right now they decided that if it's stamped on election day, that's still acceptable. So it is a lot of voter education here. For example, in Fulton County, what I tell people is order your mail-in ballot early, fill it out, and then put it in one of the drop boxes. That is the safest way because the drop boxes are going to be emptied every day. And once it's there, a few days later, usually a week later, you can see at the Secretary of State that it has been received. And then you can trace it whether it has been accepted or not. So that is, and if I think what you said is like that the biggest challenge would be that people are disenfranchised from voting. Actually, in this election where we expect so high voter turnout, That is probably true, but I think the biggest challenge is the Electoral College. And that is another very unique U.S. institution that basically makes a few states, and in this election, it's going to be Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Ohio. So that they basically decide the election regardless of how much Biden may win the popular vote. And we saw this in 2016 already. So there's really a question where we need to ask ourselves, does this really is a democratic process? And the second one is gerrymandering. And I'm a strong proponent for independent redistrict commissions because no politician should be able to pick their voters. It should be the voters picking their representatives. So we need to make sure that we draw fair districts, and to do that we need to fight for independent redistricting commissions. And but for that, here in Georgia, for example, Democrats need a seat at the table. So if we don't have a seat at the table, the Republicans in Georgia will be able to draw the district lines in a way that they can secure their majority for the next 10 years. And to me, that sounds so wrong. And I'm speaking as someone who comes from a different system. It's like that the idea that there's so much room for manipulation and that's okay or accepted. I'm not saying it's okay, but that's accepted that people say, oh, it's just the way it is. And by the way, gerrymandering, Democrats and Republicans are equally guilty of doing it. So
absolutely.
Nobody gets a free pass there. To me, it is just very, very sounds very undemocratic. And that's one of the things I very strongly will fight for when reelected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Talk about, back to that conversation about switching languages, speaking to people in their own languages. We had a conversation with the current candidate for the Public Service Commission in Georgia, Daniel Blackman, from the Democratic side. He talked to us about how you have to switch your language to speak the language of others in another party to really connect with them and to really make your views relatable to them. And I think that is more relevant than ever when regarding climate change, right? And I know you're a huge advocate for environmental issues, but you never lead with climate change, right? The number one, I'm a big environmentalist. I don't know if you know this, but I always talk about the environment and I'm huge on the environment. Big fan of Al Gore. But beyond that, I never lead with climate change, right? I always lead with the economic impacts or the impacts towards our workers and things like that before I talk about the actual environment, because the conservative people I'm talking to don't really care about what the world's going to look like 10 years from now, right? They care about what the economy is going to look like 10 years from now. And that's what really connects with them. So I have to code switch my language to really get my vision out there. Now, I want to talk to you about more than code switching, more than switching how you speak, switching how you implement actions. And we saw Atlanta commit to 100% green energy by 2035, which is completely, obviously a good promise, but bold, because right now they have 6 to 8% of their renewables creating the energy output. So I think that it's a bold plan, but how can Georgia on a bigger scale implement policies to encourage public transportation that's green, encourage the transferable kind of energies with solar energy, nuclear energy, things like this? Because I think that, I don't know if you agree with this, but I think that it really does start economically. Because if you saw back in the Obama administration, there was the recession and people started buying a Nissan lease because the government gave economic benefits to people like that. Yeah. And that was the number one thing. As a child, I saw my parents buy Nissan Leafs on the roads everywhere there was Nissan Leafs because the government gave economic subsidies. So how do you think, first of all, in general, how can we encourage environmentalism and protecting of our environments in Georgia? And second of all, how does the economy play into that? And what kind of economic things can we do to encourage Republican support for it and to encourage bipartisan support within the people for these environmental policies?
Yeah, it's very interesting how you phrase it, because you basically phrase it in the way I would say it. You cannot disconnect the environment from economic well-being of the state. It totally goes in sync. And I'm a strong supporter of driving more environmentally sensible policies in Georgia. And I'm working, for example, with some folks from the solar industry on really setting realistic solar goals. I know that the goal for 2030 or 2035 is very, very lofty. I think in Biden clean energy plan is aiming for 2050. That sounds a bit a little bit more realistically, but for example, we had one. And one thing in Georgia is, and actually Blackmon may be the better person to talk about it, is like we have a strong, powerful institution here, which is called Georgia Power, and they basically dominate what is happening on the energy market. And I would like us to really convince them to do even more in renewable energies. They have a commitment, and I would have to look at their website, so don't, they have a commitment to increasing the renewable energy footprint by a certain percent. I think it was by 2030 or 2035, so don't nail me on the numbers there, but it was only by a certain percentage, and it's up on the website, so I have to go look at this again. I want them to be even bolder there, and I think that the current pandemic actually is an opportunity to do so, because a lot of jobs are being and will be created in renewable energies. So I think if we, with everybody changing their behavior right now, and people looking for jobs, if we invest, for example, in retraining people into renewable energies and really giving the renewable energy industry more leverage to really blossom or really expand in Georgia, that would be very helpful. That would be something I would very much support. And actually, I do. I work with them. But there are a lot of things I can do, but let's wait and see where we are in November before we get ahead of ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to mention one thing before we continue here. I mean, the government, the federal government has taken advantage of the coronavirus to decrease regulations on businesses and corporations with the EPA. Like, I thought in the beginning of the coronavirus that our environmental impact would go down because there's less flights, less transportation. But right now, it looks like it's going up because the EPA has used this opportunity to roll back regulations, whereas other countries have had their impacts going down because they've stopped flying planes. They've stopped having these kinds of cars. But we've only gone up because the EPA has been taking advantage of the situation that we're in right now to increase profits for businesses regardless of the environmental impact. So I think it's interesting. I think that we have to see what happens in November, obviously, and see how we can get past this, because with the Obama plan, that was a plan that I think was reasonable. It was, I think, the most bipartisan solution we had going forward, but it was obviously revoked. We can't make a decision right now. I think you're absolutely right on that front. But go ahead, Damien.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I like the statement that we can be bolder. I think that it's always been the American idea to try to be bold, but I've seen us backing off in recent years. Especially in this, when I think of being bold, I think of the 60s and I think of the space race and I think of this huge technological push, and not only technological push, but at the same time, you have the civil rights movement, and you have this movement to bring our troops back home in the next decade. And you have all of these amazing things happening in the 60s. And I think that right now, you know, it's always the uncomfortable moments, the moments that where you're not sure what's going to happen, where you see true leaders take shape, and where you see again that American spirit, which is so important to talk about. You know, we even saw it after 9/11. We saw the American people come together. And I think that right now is an opportunity for us to try to be bold and for us to try to shoot for the stars, as we have always done. I think that we're becoming very complacent with a lot of our issues. I think that, ironically, with what the president was saying, we're having a "it is what it is" mentality, where we're just looking at something and saying "it is what it is, we'll deal with it later." And I think that that's extremely true with environmental issues. And I think that there's many fronts that we can try to be bold on. And my question to you in that sense is, what do you think is something that is overlooked or underlooked, underappreciated, an issue that doesn't get as much attention as you think that it should get?
Oh, there are just so many. And I just, I mean, we kind of like trying to talk a little bit like on the national level, and I have to always track back to the state legislator. Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to one thing I think Varun mentioned, and it was deregulation. And I'm very, very, very concerned about deregulation, because we have seen here in Georgia that we had some very severe environmental issue with the Sterigenics issue about the ethylene oxide emissions. Then we have several coal ash ponds along the watersheds that pollute our groundwater table. Juliet was one example where we had a lot of people come up and protest for clean drinking water. And one of the things what I noticed, and I'm a member of the Natural Resource Committee, is that sometimes it seems like the EPD, which is the Georgia Environmental Protection Division, really struggles to have all the resources and all the people in place to really do the oversight they're supposed to do. And it's very easy to say, oh, let's deregulate, and then that drives the economy. But I had a very interesting conversation with someone who has traveled way more than I did. And he said, the question we have to ask ourselves is, who do you want to be and who do we want to compare ourselves with? Because the regulation means that we have safe drinking water. We can drink water from our tap, and that is something we take for granted. But when you travel, for example, to countries like you just go to South America or India or wherever you travel, you know you can't drink just water from the tap. It's not safe. But you know when you go into countries like Germany and so you can do this. So, and one of the reasons you can do this is that they have a regulative administrative process in place that ensures that our drinking water is clean and safe. And that's a good thing because it's a public health issue. So I would be very caution people to be overly excited about deregulation, because we have to think long term. In the short term, yay, it might be good for business in the short term, but then we have other costs that we have to account for. So if we have a major public health crisis coming out because our drinking water is all of a sudden contaminated, like we had areas in Georgia and around Juliet, and or like just think Flint, Michigan, that generates a lot of cost for the community and a lot of economic cost. We usually don't think about in the beginning, but we just start thinking about when they happen. And it's like hindsight 2020, but hindsight 2020 can be very, very costly. So I would urge us to really caution about the really rush to saying, yes, let's deregulate, and really think like, okay, there may be things that may make sense to deregulate, but the general statement, just like because it's good for the economy, is very, very short-sighted in my mind.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I want to talk about a lot of things today. Obviously, we're coming near to our time here. I do want to talk about the fact that under Nathan Deal, I was doing some research, and under their policies, Georgia's plan for the environment was to create a set of proposals to fight the issue once it comes here. So basically, we were recognizing, and I know you know this, but we're recognizing the issue was going to happen, and we were just preparing for what to do when it happens. And I think that's absolutely ignorant of what's actually happening here. And that is a chance that we can take to prevent the really deterioration of our environment and preserve the environment in our earth for future generations. And we have that opportunity, and we can't lose it. We can't prepare for the future and accept our future, because we have a role to play. We can fix it. And back to your point, Damien, on 9/11. I want to end here in terms of personally. I want to talk about something that's very important to me. I think that after 9/11, Bush and Cheney came out and they created unity and national unity around the issues that we have, and said, we're all Americans. They recognize that people may be feeling xenophobia. They said, we're all Americans, and we have to fight as one country and fight forward as one country. And I applaud them for that. I think the president and whoever becomes president in November has to do the same exact thing with the coronavirus, because really that's a virus that's been killing people by the thousands every single day. And a virus that is not just the virus, racial tensions has been killing people on the streets. So really, they have to create that tension, the sense of unity in our nation. But to end today's podcast, I think a lot of good points were mentioned today. It's been a while since I've asked this question to any of our viewers, because we've been doing some solo episodes, mm-hmm. myself and Damien. But we always ask our viewers, our guests, this one question at the very end of our podcast. And that question is, if you had one saying, one phrase, one quote, it can be from you or somebody else, to say to America's youth to end today's podcast, what would that be?
To America's youth?
To America. Yeah. It's a very broad question. It's a quote from you, a quote from anybody else. Go ahead.
I would say is like, don't despair and look forward, and you are the future, and this comes with a lot of responsibility. It might be a lot for you at a young age, but you are the future and you are a voice, and we need to hear your voice. I've been asked a lot of what I think about youth engagement. I think it is now more than ever absolutely crucial that you make your voice heard, because whatever decisions we make affects your future. In 5 to 10 years, you have to live with the consequences of what we did or didn't do. So you have all the right to ask very, very tough questions. So ask the tough questions.
1,000%. And part of making your voice heard right now, it might seem a little bit difficult for some of our listeners that aren't 18 or can't vote yet, but it all starts with having conversations, as we say at the end of every single one of our episodes. Go out and have conversations. Have conversations with not only your leaders, but your family members, whether it be at a dinner table or in a classroom. Engage with other people, engage with other young minds, old minds, minds of the past. Read, just try to go out and have conversation with differing opinions, with similar opinions, and try to prepare yourself for that age of 18. Beyond that, something that we want to try to reiterate here in Georgia, and we're posting all of this on our website, so we're trying to keep it updated as we can. But you can sign up to be a poll worker right now, and it's something that it's extremely crucial for everyone to do. A lot of our poll workers are of the elderly population, and right now they do not feel safe being poll workers. As a youth, I think that it's something that we can do to step forward. And again, the age to do that is 16. So just another thing that you can do to be politically active before that crucial age of 18. But with that being said, I want to thank Angelica for joining us on the podcast today. I want to thank Varun, as always, for asking amazing questions. And I want to thank all of our viewers for tuning in. Be sure to check us out on Patreon at Politatine Podcast, or at patreon.com/Politatine Podcast, on Twitter at Politatine Show. Donate to our GoFundMe. We're trying to raise funds for children in low-income communities this holiday season. There's been a lot going on throughout the whole nation and throughout many communities, but one thing that we believe here at Politatine is that the youth and children shouldn't have to feel shouldn't have to struggle with that on whatever holiday they celebrate. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning into today's episode. And as always, be sure to stay tuned in for the next episode. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politatine Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/Politatine Podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/Politatine Podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/Politatine Podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politatinepodcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politatine. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation, my friend. I do appreciate your input, as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.